Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Boy, our friend Ocho was really mad at the J.J. Watt take from a little bit earlier when we played, not our take, but when we played the... Do you have the J.J. Watt talking about Ross Blacklock real quick, Ben, just to reset? Because this really set Ocho, who's a loyal listener and texter to the show. He's the one listener who's up with us every morning right at 6, texting in. And here's J.J. Watt talking about Ross Blacklock, how silly his punching a Raven penalty and ejection was on Sunday.
Stupid. And selfish. It was a stupid play. It was selfish. I've spoken to Ross before, so it pisses me off. I mean, it's a very selfish move late in the game. It's dumb. Very dumb to hurt your team in that type of setting for no reason.
All right, so that's J.J. Watt. Man, Ocho, Seth. I've talked to Blacklock before. Be who the bleep are you? And then he says, okay, this is interesting.
Wait, is he saying Blacklock, who are you, or J.J.,
no,
who are you?
No, he's saying, he's like the B word, like the biatch. He says, he puts, quote, I've talked to Blacklock before. Biatch, who the bleep are you? He's talking to J.J.,
Okay.
As if to say, like, you're airing the dirty laundry here. But then this is the one I wanted to get your take on. He says, Ocho says, I'll bet Watt can't even fight. Mofo, all muscle and no scrap. You think J.J. Watt is a good fighter? You think he can fight, or is he a guy who's just a really big dude who may not have gotten... Do you think he's been extracurricularly punched in the face before? I'm not talking about during a hockey game or in practice. I'm talking out in public.
I feel like his father would. He seems like the kind of dad that bought the kids boxing gloves for Christmas.
He's a first responder
back in the day.
He was a
fireman. I bet there was something there. Now I don't know about it wasn't like walking home from school every day. He had to fight his way to safety or anything. So I don't like when you say like how good of a fighter he is. For him, it'll all depend on whether he has any grappling skills or not. I don't know if he's just going to sit back there and actually have a boxing match with you or not. He's got a scrappiness to him that I think would serve him well.
Yeah.
So yes, I would say he can. Like when I put him versus other, like Aaron Donald versus J.J. Watt in a fight, or Aaron Donald or J.J. versus other defensive linemen in the fight, that'd be an interesting power ranking.
We should put a bracket together.
Boy, Aaron Donald looks kind of like a boxer, doesn't he? He's like a puffed up Mike Tyson. He's just so lean and muscular and compact that he looks a little bit more like a boxer than JJ does. JJ's going to have to win it with the grappling.
He's lower to the ground too. I feel that low center of gravity. You're asking me to handicap Donald versus Watt in a fight? I might give Donald the edge.
MMA style. It's not just a boxing match.
Yeah, I might give Donald the edge. Just because, J.J., it sounds weird to say because he's super muscle-bound, but compared to Donald, he's kind of long-limbed and gangly. I feel like Donald's sort of, fire hydrant physique compared to J.J. would be beneficial to him in that. I don't know. I'm not an MMA expert, but I'm just trying to apply logic to this. Plus, Donald is younger and healthier, too.
Yeah, do kids, I don't know how much kids are getting fist fights anymore like they used to.
No.
Is it common? Text in 713-572-4610. I don't like that. You see it on YouTube and everything all the time, but I just don't know how rare that is versus, no. It's just gotten increasingly, and for good reason, it's gotten increasingly less acceptable over the years.
I don't know.
I know a lot of these schools now have like zero tolerance policies.
Is it more acceptable? Like, is that approach better, or do they just torment each other on social media with bots and burner accounts now? I feel like settling it with good old-fashioned fisticuffs, you've at least got clarity in how you feel about each other, as opposed to Joe Blow going home and creating four Twitter accounts and telling the kid that he's nothing, you know, or tormenting a young lady into an eating disorder or something like that.
That's true. Yeah. What's worse is that, like, oh, every now and then a kid ends up with a lazy eye the rest of his life because he got some nerve damage, versus like the multitudes of people that are psychologically tormented the rest of their lives
on
social media. Okay. Yeah. What would you rather have your child subjected to? Physical bullying or just like extreme social media bullying? If you had to choose, oh, that's tough. That's a really tough one. I don't like this game, Sean.
You're the one who started it.
I know. Well, if it's a one-time, physical bullying, I would say, okay, yeah, do the physical bullying.
Yep.
Take the physical. But it's the problem. It's that day in, day out psychological trauma of getting. If you get bullied every day on the way home from school, that's a rough one to go through. I went through that for a little while. When I was a kid, I was getting bullied every day on my way home from school.
Psychologically or physically?
No, physically. Yeah. Physically. I ended up, I challenged a kid to go fight me. I was at Riccio's, the little ice cream shop we had. And I was like in maybe fifth, sixth grade, and this kid was like in eighth grade. So I was nervous as hell. My brother had told me. It's like one of the best pieces of my advice my brother told me. He told me how to fight, and then he also told me that if it gets really bad, to ball up in a circle. Luckily, I would never live there. So, but it was the classic, like, I was sitting at this stool at Riccio's waiting for my spot at pinball. That's how old I am. There was a pinball machine. And this kid, Sam, comes up to me, and he wanted to rough me up again and, like, push me around a little bit, and he was, like, slapping me. I was like, that's it, Sam. Let's go. And I walked out, and he just stayed in there. And that was it. That was the end of it. Sam,
so hold up. He turtled and backed down? He didn't fight you?
Yeah, he was, like, much bigger than me, but he was a total, like, I don't even know if he was a – I don't know if he was like an actual bully now that I think back on it. He was just 3 years older than me. And he tried to pass it off like, no, I'm not going to fight you. You'll just go tell and I'll get in trouble.
Bully but, like Tarzan, you know. Play like Jane. Wow.
Yeah, I hesitate to ever give the advice, hey, the way to stop a bully is to stand up to him, because sometimes that will get your ass beat. That's actually probably usually worse advice than good advice.
How much older is your brother than you?
He's 3 years older too.
Okay, so he was about the same delta. So did he beat the crap out of you on a regular basis? In some ways, was he sort of preparing you for that fight with any sort of? It sounds like that boxing glove story you just told is something that actually happened to you as a kid, where you got boxing gloves.
Yeah, I don't know if my brother. See, my brother, if anything, like, I don't think he prepared me to fight. He got me accustomed to getting my ass beat.
Okay.
Because I couldn't fight. Like, I wasn't big enough. He was way bigger than me, and he was 3 years older than me. So he and my stepbrother, yeah, we got boxing gloves for Christmas one year, and I was like, thanks a lot, Dad. Thanks for this next 6 hours of my life where Dan and Tom are going to take me out behind the barn and beat the snot out of me.
Yeah.
But you learn. That an ass whooping's not that big a deal at some point. It's just you get on with your life.
What was your go-to at Riccio's ice cream parlor? What did you get? What
they
was
had
the best thing?
They had like bubblegum ice cream.
Yeah.
It'd be like it was pretty good.
That's good
the
stuff.
Sugar cone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I used to get too.
It was an old school soda shop. It was like the place kids would go after school, and they had a few pinball machines and soda and ice cream and everything.
Did the guy behind the counter have a bow tie and the little elastic bands around his sleeve and say, hey, how you doing there, kiddo? How you doing, Mackie? What would you like there? Can I get you a malted there, Mackie? Can I get you a malted and some french fries?
No, it was just a fat Italian kid and who was related to the barber shop next door, who was also the town bookie, which was cool.
Yeah, no numbers being run out of that place. The ice cream parlor named Riccio's. Did you ever go in the back and see what was going on back there, Seth? Because if not, I can tell you what was going on in the back of Riccio's ice cream parlor next to Riccio's barber shop, which was next to the pork store.
No. It was the barber shop was where the action was.
Yeah,
that was where the bookie was in the barber shop.
Yeah.
That's what I always heard growing up.
My hometown, the first time I ever got into the and this is back before the internet, so the first time I ever got into, old school placing bets, used to call a bookie on the phone. I was at the barber shop in the barber chair talking to the barber. I was an adult at this point, but I said, man, I'd really like to get down on the Super Bowl. It was that first Buffalo-Dallas Super Bowl back in 92. I was right out of college, and I'm getting my hair cut in the barbershop. He goes, you want to get down on that game? Hang on 1 second. And he gets on the phone. He walks over the phone. He's like, hey, Tommy, I got one for you. All right. He hangs up the phone. He sends me over to the sporting goods store in town. And that's where it ran. And that's where in the wrong side of the tracks of Simsbury, Connecticut, the hard scrabble streets on Hop Meadow Street in Simsbury, Connecticut, that's where the numbers were run out of there, out of the sporting goods store back in the day.
Was it like a kid wearing a referee's shirt that took your bets?
No, it was the guy who owned the store. It was.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was who we used to buy our sporting goods from every year. I'm like, holy crap, there's a whole other thing going on. I think he later became mayor of the town, if you want to know the truth.
I mean, the way that works, like in a small town, when you got a guy as the bookie here or there, like the cops know about it, right? They just figure, like, okay, it's like whatever.
Yes.
We're not going to deal with it.
100%. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
I mean, it's like we don't want to run an investigation on this, and maybe he's an alderman or something like that. Is that the deal usually?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, correct. That's 100% the truth. So,
and then some young kid comes onto the force, and he's like, I'm going to clean this town up.
Yeah.
And then after
a
while,
and then people like me are like, no, there's no internet yet. Don't clean it up. I got to get my action to. I don't want to lose the opportunity to drop $550 a week off at the sporting goods store. No.
Well, that's like the Simpsons episode with the brothel in town, right? Where everybody knows about it, and then somebody has to speak up, and it screws it for all those guys.
Stop ruining it for all of us degenerates. Yeah. There was a crucial juncture early in the Baltimore game that everybody is talking about. Seth has something about that sequence, though, that nobody is talking about. We'll continue to sift through the Ravens game next.
Watson gets behind Nick Martin. He's got motion. Watson, mini boot, throws. It's incomplete. Texans turn it over on downs as the pressure was there immediately in the form of Deshaun Elliott. Yeah.
That was the play early in the game where the Texans went for it on 4th-and-1 in their own territory at their own 34-yard line. After an incomplete pass on 3rd-and-1, they ran another pass play on 4th-and-1. And they don't convert. The Ravens get the ball on a short field. They score a touchdown. And really, at that point, didn't look back. They go up 10-0. The Texans cut it to 10-7, I think, or maybe 13-7. The bottom line was that put the Ravens at least in early control of the game. And, Seth, that was an interesting sequence because they did get John Harbaugh to flinch a little bit and that he did call timeout when they lined up for it on 4th-and-1. They looked like they were lined up ready to power run the thing on 4th-and-1 the first time. And then when they came out of the timeout, it gave Bill O'Brien and Tim Kelly a chance to think about it a little bit, which is always the worst thing in the world, it feels like. And they end up running that play that we just heard right there.
And I'm glad you set it up that way because I do want to give them credit for, I think, having a plan on going for it on 4th-and-1. I couldn't tell on watching the All-22 because you can't tell how much time there is. I can't remember how quickly they got up to the line. But usually, if you're going to go for it on 4th-and-1, you want to know that you're going to go for it when on 3rd-and-1. You've got a plan for, okay, this is the two-play sequence, and this is how we're going to do it. So it's smart of John Harbaugh, for one, to call that timeout because it does give you time to avoid getting, you know, caught off guard with whatever the heck's about to come up. So I think they did a good job there. My issue, and I know a lot of people have the issue with the boot on 4th-down, I hear people say it in such a way that frankly confuses me because they'll say, well, you ran a boot into a blitz. And I guess that's, you know, the element of surprise with a blitz is part of not knowing that a blitz is coming. Just because the safety is up there doesn't mean that he's necessarily blitzing. So I don't have as much of an issue with, like, in general, running a boot on 4th-and-short. I think when you have an athletic quarterback like Deshaun, it makes sense. I do think that you shouldn't be running the boot, a naked boot, unless you're pretty sure that the team that you're playing is going to bite on the naked boot. So on 3rd-and-1, that defensive end, outside linebacker, did not bite at all. Like, he was waiting right there for Deshaun. There was no deception. Usually if you're running zone blocking away from that defensive end and he's really biting on it hard and he's playing the run every time, then, man, all right, we got a good feel that we can get our quarterback open on a naked boot. So I have as much of an issue with a 3rd-and-1 call. They call this naked boot, and it's dead in the water because the end rusher just stayed home. And that's where I wonder, okay, you just saw that. So regardless of whether they run a blitz or not, you just saw the boot not work. You just saw that they're not biting on this. What on earth makes you think that in crunch time, running the same relative action the next play is going to get better results. That's what really bothered me.
Yeah, Clint had an issue with that in the post game too, and the issue I think was similar to what you're talking about. Clint, and I'm paraphrasing, so Clint, if you're listening and I'm butchering this, just let me know. But he didn't have a huge issue with them going for it on fourth down. It's that they went for it and they looked like they didn't have a plan. It looked like they decided to go for it just in the moment haphazardly, and it wasn't anything that they, like you said, Seth, like that they didn't really have any sort of sequence built in as to what they wanted to do, that they just decided sort of in the moment to go for it there.
Except that you got that problem of the timeout.
Yeah.
And that's where if you could get up to the line and you could run what they had planned on doing if the Ravens hadn't called the timeout. Because I'm correct, right? The Ravens called that timeout?
They did, yes.
Yeah, the Ravens called the timeout.
Yes.
Then it becomes, okay, this is Tim Kelly versus Wink Martindale here.
Oh,
who's going to win this chess match?
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, I don't know, would other offensive coordinators have anticipated blitz in that situation based on Wink Martindale's tendencies? I don't know. So the play call itself was more, it's not the situation that bothered me. And by the way, the chance going for it on fourth down there, just making that decision, according to one metric, improved the Texans' odds of winning the game by, I think, 3.4%. So you could say it's a bad decision or overly risky or what have you. If Bill O'Brien was going by the analytics, I think a lot of the people that crushed O'Brien for not going for it at midfield last week shouldn't be allowed to crush him for going for it this week if you're basing it on the analytics.
Yeah.
But part of it is knowing whether you can convert or not. What are the chances that you're going to convert, and all those other things that go into a game? That sometimes I feel like the stat heads don't recognize that there are differences in teams, and just using the stats that apply to blank situations doesn't mean that in your given situation you should feel confident about making a fourth down.
I think a lot of the stat heads say you should go for it on fourth and one all the time. You know what I mean? Like, even if you're at your own 20 and it's early in the game and there's been no flow to the game established where, yeah, the other team's moving the ball on us and possessions are going to be more important than punting it when they'll just drive 70 yards instead of 20 yards to get a score, that kind of thing. I think the stat heads say you go for it on fourth and one all the time. I don't think most coaches aren't quite there yet, but O'Brien's clearly in a place where he's more risk tolerant. And Seth, that's why I wanted them to go for it on fourth and four at the 50 early in the Kansas City game. I think the same reasons why O'Brien went for it on that fourth and one at their own 34 in the Ravens game are the same reasons why, similar juncture in the game, you know, it's still early in the first half, fourth and four at the 50 against the Chiefs is a time to go for it for me. Because let's face it, this is a team that chances are is going to take the ball, and whether they're driving from their own 20 or they're driving from the 50, they're probably going to drive the ball on you in this defense. You got to know who your opponent is, bottom line. Yeah. So,
QT's, by way of just comparison, that stat, it's the game-winning chance. I think that's what it stands for. QT's fumble cost the Texans 13.4%. They were 13.4% less likely to win the game.
That's a massive swing. For those who don't have any context with that stat that you're talking about, 13.4% for one play is a gigantic number.
Yeah, thanks, Kiki.
Yeah, way to go, Kiki. I'm looking, Seth, if you're having rewatched that game and just seen how much the Ravens blitz, the Steelers blitz the most of any team in the league. If you're the Steelers defensive coordinator, if you're Mike Tomlin, the head coach who's a defensive guy, I mean, are you basically just blitzing the Texans this weekend until they show you that they can actually pick some things up and that their IQ has improved over the last 6 days?
Yeah, I think so. Now, yeah, you know why? Especially because I'm thinking back to some of the good plays in the game, and I think that at least one of the brighter things that came out of the game was that, look, with Will Fuller severely limited, Brandon Cooks showed up big in a few spots. There was one moment on one of Deshaun's sacks, though, where Brandon Cooks would have been wide open for a touchdown, and the Texans' offensive line picked up the blitz perfectly, but Max Sharping just got his butt whooped on the play, and Deshaun had no place. Deshaun had no chance at all. Like, there just wasn't enough time for the play to develop. This is where I started to get concerned, because right there, hey, it was a perfect play call. It was a perfect play call. They had max protection. They were blocking with eight guys, so the blitz didn't matter. They picked it up. It just came down to, oh, you can't trust Max Sharping to win a one-on-one. You can't trust Zach Fulton to win a one-on-one. You certainly can't trust Titus Howard to win a one-on-one. You know, right now, only 40% of your offensive line, two out of five players, are playing football at a winning level on the offensive line. And that's obviously not going to beat defenses like the Pittsburgh Steelers if you continue to play like that. They absolutely have to get a lot better very quickly this week if they want to beat the Steelers.
I'll give you some numbers that should scare the hell out of you if you're a Texan fan or if you're somehow related to Deshaun Watson. The Steelers defense, first in the league in pressure rate. They pressure the quarterback, Seth, 46% of dropbacks. So basically half the time a quarterback drops back, they're facing pressure. That's what Deshaun's had to deal with already against the Chiefs and the Ravens. Now you get the Steelers coming who've done it against two teams this season already, against the Giants and the Broncos. They're number one in blitz rate. They blitz nearly 58% of the time. They're blitzing nearly 58% of the time. They're second in the league in pressure rate on a blitz. They are first in the league in pressure rate on non-blitz. Basically, there's no metric that involves pressuring the passer, blitz or non-blitz, where the Steelers aren't either number one or number two in the league right now.
Yeah, and I also, like, I always, I take those stats with a grain of salt because sometimes I can't tell or know whether, you know, sometimes with the defense, a really savvy linebacker is just going to hug rush where if the running back is staying into pass block, he's going to figure out, or he's got tendencies on whether he should rush or not. So it's different than dialing up a blitz in the huddle. Suffice it to say that the Steelers are really, really good at getting extra people to the quarterback or involved in the blitz. And the Texans so far have been really, really bad at figuring those types of things out. Like this week's challenge is as much a mental one as it is a physical one for the Texans.
We should point out the two lines the Steelers have gone against so far are the Giants and the Broncos. So these are not
okay.
These are not great offensive lines. These are younger teams. These are non-playoff teams from last year. One of them's got a brand new head coach. The other one has a head coach who's in his second year and is a defensive coordinator. So these are teams. If you're looking for a tailor-made situation as best you can through 2 weeks of the season to lead the league in every pressure category, the Steelers have had that situation so far. That's still a really good defense, don't get me wrong, but Giants and the Broncos, not exactly murderer's row.
Right, well, you're right. But, the Steelers did lead the league in sacks last year.
So they're really good, yeah.
Yeah. And also, look, okay, the fact that they played those two teams, you might be able to say, well, they shouldn't be ranking this high in percentage of time. It's these teams. But I think in looking at the Texans' offensive line, are the Steelers going to game plan much differently for the Texans' offensive line than they did for those two teams? Probably not.
They're
not facing a good offensive line.
That's right.
You know, those guys, this is the kind of game where T.J. Watt and Bud Dupree will start getting in fights over who gets to line up over Titus Howard. They'll say sometimes, I don't know if there's a young interior defensive lineman, sometimes a guy like T.J. could be like, no, kid, you go out and you rush over the outside because I got to get me some of this Max Sharping action or Zach Fulton action right now.
They're going to be like two animals on the Nature Channel fighting over the meatier parts of Deshaun Watson by the fourth quarter. No,
like
I
hyenas.
Want the leg. No, I want to. No, you take the arms. I take the legs. No. All right.
I shouldn't be laughing about the Deshaun part. I'm just thinking about the absurdity of it.
It's a metaphor.
They got to get. They don't have to get better. Look, they can only get so much better. It's the same as we say every single damn year with this offense. Same thing as any poet or philosopher, Jack Easterby, will tell you: simplify, 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 simplify.
Right.
Life is so much easier when you simplify and stop trying to be so perfect all the time.
Let's go around the league. Let's look into the Texans' crystal ball and look at some of the other games around the NFL over the weekend. The first 2 months get even a little bit scarier if you're the Texans. We'll get to that next. And let's go around the league now that the week two is in the books. Monday Night Football last night, if you missed it, the Raiders with an upset of the Saints in their first game in their new stadium in Las Vegas, which looks like a really nice stadium.
The Death Star. Even though the Death Star was blown up, they still like calling it the Death Star.
Yeah, it does. It looks, you know, it's got that Raider color to it. I'm not going to lie, Seth, as somebody who is a Vegas enthusiast, seeing NFL broadcasts on Monday Night Football with the Vegas skyline in the background made me feel a certain kind of way. I'm not going to lie. It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It
stinks that was the first time last night where the lack of fans really got to me a little bit. Where I realized, man, this is This is supposed to be a really cool moment for a city that's been excited about getting this team for a couple of years now, and just to have to sit at home and watch it with no opportunity to go to the game kind of sucks.
Yeah, it did. It did. Now, the good news is that, look, it stinks that there's no fans. The league continues to handle the pandemic practically flawlessly. Heading into the games on Sunday, Seth, all negative tests for all the players, all the staff. The NFL just keeps needing to do what they're doing here, and we're going to get a full season out of this thing.
Honestly, like, if anything, the thing that's most encouraging about this to me is that there's just no possible way that of the 1,500 players there, that all of their families are being as careful as they should be, you know, 24 hours a day.
Got to be
and
one.
And that relatively, it seems like the stuff that people are doing away from home, like relatively achievable, you know, social distancing things seem to have a pretty successful effect on it. Like, yeah. That's pretty impressive.
Yep. So let's go around the league and take a look back at week two with a particular slant in looking at this from a Texans, either a Houston Texans or an actual person who lives in Texas perspective, because that's where we'll start. I don't know that the Texans have a keen interest in what's going on with the Cowboys because they don't play the Cowboys this year, but I know there's some of you listening who are probably Cowboy fans, so let's start there. In one of the more exciting early games, really one of the most exciting games of the early season, early on here in 2 weeks, the Cowboys with a huge comeback against the Atlanta Falcons. The Cowboys, multiple times in this game, Seth, fell behind by 19 points. They were down by two touchdowns late in the fourth quarter. They were down by 9 points with just, I think, under 5 minutes to go in the game. Like, it was tough sledding for the Dallas Cowboys in this game. The key play in the game, once the Cowboys scored a touchdown to make it 39-37, was one of the more unique onside kicks you're ever going to see. Greg Zuerlein put the ball not on a tee, he put it on its side and kicked the thing pumpkin style onside, and here's what happened.
For the onside kick, Zuerlein dribbles it to the left, hadn't gone 10 yards. Big scramble for it as it has gone 10 yards. Cowboys think they got it.
I think they did.
I mean, that's not even possible anymore, is it?
Atlanta just let it roll and roll, and it went 10, and the Cowboys have the football.
Jeff, did you see this onside kick? Did you see the Atlanta Falcons and what they were doing? They looked at it and treated it like it was a live grenade.
Yeah, that's where I think it's like they hadn't been coached on the basics of the, not just the onside kick, but just the rule in general. The receiving team is allowed to touch it whenever you want. Right. If you're the kicking team, that's when you're not allowed to touch it until it goes 10 yards. I think that these new onside rules where it's made it very, very hard to get an onside kick has meant that you have to resort to just trying to throw up something different and hope that the receiving team messes it up.
Yeah.
And that's what happened, I suppose.
Yep.
There's nothing more terrifying than being the hands guy, the guy that's supposed to receive the onside kick, which I only had to do it a couple times in my life. And then looking back on it, I think my coach must have hated me because I have horrible hands. Horrible. And I don't know if he just thought that I was like gutsy enough to do it or something. But I'm not ashamed. I was scared crapless every single time I did it. You get it. The old rules, they get this running start at you, and they can hit you as hard as they want. This is not what that was.
Yeah, it was not. The Cowboys recover the kick. They kick a field goal to win the game. Quick factoid.
Go ahead.
Mike
McCarthy went for two when they were down 9 in this game. That a lot of people had an issue with. I think it makes a whole lot of sense. If you don't convert, instead of putting it off until later when you'd absolutely have to make the 2-point conversion, you do it now. If you don't make it, then you can adjust your game theory after that.
Yeah, the nerds say that's the way to do it. The one factoid entering Sunday, Seth, team scoring 39 points with no turnovers committed. We're 440-0 since 1933, thanks to the Falcons, who are good at historic coughing up of leads, as we know.
Oh, boy.
They're now 440-1. Let's get to the next game here. This is one that Texan fans should take a keen interest in because it's a battle of two future opponents. Weeks 5 and 6, they will play the Jacksonville Jaguars and Tennessee Titans. Jags got some pluck to them this year, man. They lose this game 33-30, but the Jags came back from a big early deficit, but the Titans were able to salt this one away with a turnover.
Minshew pops, throws, ball batted in the air, intercepted! Intercepted!
Yes!
Harold Landry, the man who batted it! Big Jeff, the man who caught it! Harold Landry, and the Minshew Show ends as the curtain goes down with 47 seconds to go.
Seth, the Titans are 2-0 for the first time since 2008, and if people remember that year, they actually went 13-3 with Kerry Collins at quarterback. That's how long it's been since the Titans have started the season with two wins. But here they are, two wins with field goals in the last couple minutes of games here by Steven Gostkowski to get off to a 2-0 start.
I think the thing that probably would have surprised people, if you went back to, say, the beginning of the 2019 season and said there was going to be a thrilling game between these two quarterbacks, Gardner Minshew and Ryan Tannehill, somebody would have slapped you and then slapped your mother.
They said, who's Gardner Minshew is what they would have said.
Yeah, Gardner Minshew, oh, no big deal, just three touchdown drives in the second half to tie it at 30-30.
He's fun.
I guess what's relevant to Texans fans here would be that, you know, DJ Chark, people knew that name. Laviska Shenault is a rookie for the Jaguars that's emerging too. So when you wonder, okay, well, how the Jaguars actually going to threaten people and beat teams this year, Gardner Minshew is probably better than you wanted him to be, and Laviska Shenault and DJ Chark are viable weapons for him. So they've got ways to score.
Yeah, no doubt about it. The Jags are 1-1 on the season. The Texans in sole possession of last place at 0-2. The only other team we haven't mentioned is the Indianapolis Colts. We'll mention them here. They beat up on the Minnesota Vikings 28-11. That's the Texans, again, two future Texans opponents. They play the Vikings a week from this coming Sunday. And the big story in this one, looks like the Colts may have found themselves a running back.
First and goal at the 5-yard line. It's Taylor again, cuts back.
Take it in, he's close to the goal line.
No signal yet. There it is. There touchdown. It is. Jonathan Taylor, a 5-yard run across the goal line into pay dirt. Touchdown, INDY.
Seth, this was one of those oh crap picks, if you're a Texan fan, when the Colts selected Jonathan Taylor out of Wisconsin. He had 101 yards and a touchdown on Sunday. To me, the bigger number with Jonathan Taylor, as we're going to sit here and probably do this over the next few years, compare the roster building going on in Tennessee, Jacksonville, and Indianapolis with the completely different type of roster building going on here. Quick fix. Jonathan Taylor's cap hit this year, $1.4 million. That's about a tenth of what David Johnson's cap hit is this year. Who would you rather have, Jonathan Taylor or David Johnson on your team?
Well, David Johnson had a good opening game, Sean. Maybe you've forgotten that already. Maybe you've forgotten that after one game, it was all, oh, hey, no big deal. You lost DeAndre. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, he fell back down to earth.
How big a problem are the Colts?
The Colts are as big a problem as Philip Rivers is a problem.
Okay.
So I guess they come, like, Philip Rivers in a weird way.
So ask you next. Way, ask you every week is basically the
answer.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to be a problem. I don't think that Philip Rivers is completely dead in the water or anything.
Yeah.
I think that Philip Rivers is going to continue to he'll botch some games at the end, but yeah. They make me nervous. Yeah.
Payne and Pendergast were going around the league.
Well, actually, no. And Jonathan Taylor is going to be an issue for this run defense if they don't figure out a few of these things.
Yeah, that offensive line for the Colts really, really good. The Texans' opponent this weekend is the Pittsburgh Steelers. They're 2-0 on the season now. They beat the Denver Broncos 26-21. One thing the Steelers can do, you can count on it. Whether it's this year, whether it's 15 years ago, they find wide receivers on day two and day three of the draft. This year it's Chase Claypool.
Roethlisberger back, looks out to his left, lost one along the sideline, going for Chase Claypool, who catches it in stride. Claypool stays in bounds, crosses the 20, the 15, the 10. The rookie Chase Claypool in for his first NFL touchdown, 84 yards, Roethlisberger to Claypool.
Whether it's Hines Ward, whether it's Antonio Brown, Seth, whether it's Emmanuel Sanders, Mike Wallace, it doesn't matter. This team seems to find, God, Juju Smith-Schuster, they find wide receivers that are non-first-round picks, and they turn them into really good NFL wide receivers. Well, these guys are going to be an issue for the Texans on Sunday.
That was the thing that was always interesting about the Antonio Brown trade was, do you remember, what was the compensation the Steelers got for
Third and a fifth.
Third and a fifth. That's what I kept seeing people write. Look, you don't go out and find an Antonio Brown with a third round pick.
They got him in the sixth.
He was a sixth round pick. Why are you phrasing this way? Why would you say that? Now, typically that would be the case. Like it is, look, it's really hard. I would caution against any other team expecting to find an Antonio Brown in the sixth round.
Yeah.
Unless you're the Pittsburgh Steelers. Not that you can find an Antonio Brown, but man, they just seem to find guys that are not premier not premier talents for whatever reason and get premier work out of them.
Let's get to another game that has Texans implications. This one more an emotional implication than anything else. DeAndre Hopkins had another nice game for the Arizona Cardinals, including his first touchdown.
Snap to Murray. Three-step drop. Fires deep middle. Wide open is DeAndre Hopkins in the back of the end zone for his first touchdown as a Cardinal. He was wide open, and the Cardinals strike first with 9:09 to go in the first quarter.
Seth, how often did we hear Mark Vandermeer say the words, wide open DeAndre Hopkins when he was here? Wide open.
Look at that. It was generally like, what? Three defenders draped on top of him, right. But D-Hop comes down with the ball.
Oh, yeah. Factoid for you here. DeAndre Hopkins, 22 catches, the most in the history of the league for a player in his first two games with a new team. So there you go. 22. He had eight catches on Sunday.
This was much more of a possession receiver type of performance.
Yes.
Which, in a lot of respects, is why you get DeAndre Hopkins. Make them play DeAndre very aggressively and open up things for other people.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as like, hey, if you have a bunch of speed out there, the defense won't know what to do with themselves. They got so much speed. Having really good wide receivers out there helps. And DeAndre Hopkins is that. I thought that the Redskins' pass rush is for real. It's just that they can't seem to do much more of anything else
yeah.
in coverage, but they can rush the passer. So I'm curious, like, exactly what I think Washington will surpass expectations this year just because Ron Rivera has Chase Young now and he is such a good defensive coordinator. It's all just down to, okay, how much does Dwayne Haskins, like, what does he turn into a viable NFL
quarterback?
Here's
the thing, Seth, they've already beat the Eagles once. Who's saying they can't beat him again? And the Giants just lost Saquon Barkley. They could go 4-0 against those two teams, and Vegas' expectations were 5.5 wins. So they could go 4-0 against those two teams. All they need to do is find two other wins on the schedule, Washington does. Last one here as we go around the league, and this one doesn't really have any Texan implications, other than they do play the Patriots in Week 10 this year. But this was, again, a really fun game to watch over the weekend. Seattle and New England on Sunday night, and the Seattle Seahawks moved to 2-0 on the season as they get a big stop on literally the last play of the game to save the game.
Cam takes the snap. He'll keep it. Running left side. Dives, and he's tripped up shy of the goal line. It's over. The Seahawks will hang on and win. Newton kept it on a quarterback sweep to the left, and he got tripped up. He went airborne, went down shy of the goal line, and the Seattle Seahawks survive.
Cam Newton stopped at the goal line. He had two rushing touchdowns on the night already. Russell Wilson, 5 touchdown passes for the 35 Seattle points. They win 35-30. His 5 touchdown passes, Seth, Russell Wilson's 5 touchdown passes, go to 5 different receivers, and they were taken in the 3rd, 2nd, 7th, 6th, and 7th rounds, respectively. And my fear is that's going to embolden Bill O'Brien to load up on 6th and 7th round picks now in the draft. He's going to trade his 3rd round pick that he has for 4th, 6th, and a 7th or something like that.
I was going to say, do you expect him to have any draft picks left by the time?
Probably.
You
got
to remember, you're expecting Bill O'Brien to stand pat and wait until May without trading away at least 50% of his picks. I'm not so sure that's possible, Sean. Also, let me ask you, Sean, this is a quick little guessing game. What percentage of New England's offense do you think was single-handedly provided by Cam Newton in that game?
So either rushing yards from him plus passing yards from him?
Yeah, I guess not single-handedly, but involved Cam Newton.
Yeah, I'm going to say the passing yards, all of them obviously, plus the rushing. I'm going to say about 80%.
95%.
95%? Wow.
Because the rest of the rushing attack gained 20 yards on 14 non-Newton carries.
What did he have on the night?
I don't know what he had. I'm just looking at the stat about it. He completed 5 of 8 passes under pressure.
He's looked good these first two games.
This has been a pretty good $2 million purchase by the Patriots.
And
as people should continue to point out to people like me, yeah, anybody could have had him. Anybody could have had him for the price of $3 million. Anybody could have had him. But no, the Patriots got him.
Yep.
The Patriots got him.
Patriots got Cam Newton. Let me look here real quick and just see the box score. Cam Newton, because I want to see
he had 70.
11 carries for 47 yards. No, they had nothing on the ground. Sony Michel was the next leading rusher with 19 yards. 11 carries, 47 yards. You concerned about 26 carries through 2 weeks, Seth, for Cam Newton at all?
I would be. I just wonder. I would think the plan is to ease that back.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he's Cam's going to be Cam, and just maybe they just ride that until it breaks.
I'm not seeing a ton of carries where he's getting brutalized like he was in Carolina either. I think they're using him very smartly.
You said that the other week, and then I went back and watched, and he was like, I mean, they're running like designed quarterback run plays. They end with getting tackled.
Yeah, I know,
they are running back style plays.
They are. I just feel like in Carolina they ran him between the tackles quite a bit. Is all. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll have to go back and look. All right, we head into the 9 o'clock hour. So those opening drive numbers for the Texans that we've brought up on the show a couple of times, I asked Bill O'Brien about them yesterday. You'll hear his response. And how did his predecessor during the Texans' best season do in that metric as well? We'll talk about it next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.